From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point on Sunday. As on many days in the long run-up to the war with Iraq, America was bursting with peace protests in Detroit, in St. Paul, in Pittsburgh, in Oklahoma City, and Albuquerque, and L.A., and many more towns and cities. On Monday, the president, in effect, sent the country charging into war. The peace movement against war with Iraq was extraordinary in many respects. It was global. It was fully formed before the first shot was fired. It was passionate and populous and turbocharged by the web. And in the end, war is coming anyway. So, was the peace movement a bust? Did it ever have a chance? Some say it was flawed from the start. Others say it was glorious and that it's not over. Tonight on Point, on the cusp of war with Iraq, we ask, was the peace movement a failure? Do bombs over Baghdad mean the movement was a bust? Did the peace movement make a difference? Did it alienate you or draw you in? Has it changed at least the conversation or not? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now in the studio is Randall Forsberg, Executive Director of the Institute for Defense and Disarmament Studies, a Cambridge, Massachusetts think tank. Randall Forsberg has done research on peace and disarmament since 1968. She wrote the manifesto that launched the nuclear weapons freeze campaign in 1980. She is also director of UrgentCall.org, a national web-based coalition for education on arms control issues. Good evening, and very good to have you, Randall Forsberg.
Hi, it's great to be here.
Thanks for coming in. And with us tonight, David Korn, joining us from Tacoma Park, Maryland. He is Washington editor of The Nation. His most recent book is the novel Deep Background. David Korn, good evening, and welcome to On Point.
Good to be with you.
Thank you so much for joining us. Randall Forsberg, you've been in the peace wing for a long, long time. You must have watched with enormous interest and a lot of involvement the peace movement over the last, you name it, 6 months, a year. I don't know how we'll define it tonight.
Right.
It was loud. It was all over the media. We'll talk about whether or not it was adequately represented there, but we saw a fair bit of it before it was all over. It was all over the world, and yet we are now headed into war with Iraq any day, any hour. Does that mean the peace movement was a bust?
Well, I have to agree that we didn't get quite as far as we would like to have. Obviously, people are devastated that there's going to be a war. But I don't think it was a bust. I mean, this was an unprecedented peace movement before the fact. As far as I know, there's never been anything like that in history, where you had enormous demonstrations that were not produced by the war or by some harm that was happening, like when we had nuclear testing in the atmosphere and people turned out to stop it. But you had them before the harm occurred, and they were very, very big. The other thing that was unique this time is the fact that it was global, and it was coordinated in a global way. The February 15th demonstrations had 6 million people around the world all demonstrating on the same day. So that made it the biggest public protest in history by a lot. So I think people have learned from previous public protest movements that they need to turn out early, that they shouldn't wait, and that it reflected a tremendous amount of learning and a lot of new strength that wasn't there in the past.
There's a lot to talk about here, and we want to dig into it tonight, but I guess here's one well, the first measure is the war's going ahead. So as you say, you can hardly call it a complete success because it's not peace. The second, and there are many ways to look at this, and there are many polls and many numbers, but let me just pull up one. Here's Gallup polling, and I'm looking at the fever chart as it goes across here. Gallup polling from October, the week of October 21, or on 21 and 22nd last fall. That is before the first big peace protest in Washington on October 26th. And it shows, in response to this question, would you favor or oppose invading Iraq with U.S. ground troops in an attempt to remove Saddam Hussein from power? This is before the first peace protest. 54% in favor. 40% opposing. Now, here it is from March 14th and 15th, just a couple of days ago.
Right.
64% favor, 33% opposing. In other words, more people favoring invasion, fewer opposing. Does this mean, and I know it's a new, there's plenty of room for nuance here, but does it mean that the peace protest not only didn't stop the war, but failed to win the hearts and minds, that it actually is this lost ground over the course of the peace campaign?
Well, I noticed those statistics right away myself, and I've spent a good deal of time the last 2 days thinking about it. I think even more, I would underline even more what you said in a way, because if you asked the question last October, would you favor going in without UN support, there was not a majority. There was a minority.
Understood.
And this time, the question was asked without UN support. Mm-hmm. And it was, you know, two-thirds for, one-third against on that question. And I think that the reason for that doesn't really have anything much to do with the peace movement. I'll come back to that. I think it's mainly the bully pulpit of the president. I mean, the only thing that the great majority of Americans have seen on television repeatedly is the president's statements about Iraq has weapons of mass destruction. But as a matter of fact, there's been no evidence given of that. This is a claim by the U.S.
But they've also seen the banners, no war for oil. You know, they've seen the banners from abroad, very
yeah.
critical of George
right.
Bush. They've seen the signs, don't have our boys die for SUVs at
yeah.
the gas pump.
Right.
They've seen all that as well.
Well, let me get back to where I think the peace movement could be stronger. And this doesn't relate just to the peace movement, but also to the media. People have said recently that, oh, the peace movement is getting way too much coverage. It's on the front page of the Times. It's on the front page of the Post. And
doesn't deserve it, you're saying, people say?
Well, but that's only been for a few weeks in the last month. I mean, I know because I was very active starting last summer, not just in the fall, because there was talk about this war from last summer. There were lots and lots of demonstrations and protests and discussion and dialogue of putting forward alternatives that were not covered in any major print, radio, or television
media. So you're saying the peace campaign was cheated of its full long run-up
right,
to the
first
moment
thing,
of war.
But it relates to a second thing, and mm-hmm. that is the banners, the posters. I mean, I think many people, both in the United States and overseas, think that this war must be about oil because they can't see what else it could be about because of the fact that the administration officials keep claiming there are weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, but there's no evidence been given so far. They claim that Iraq would give these to al-Qaeda, but there's no evidence of a link. You know, they say that this country is a threat, but as a matter of fact, there are 78 other countries that could have chemical or biological weapons, and many of them have repressive governments. And so why have we picked this country,
Randall
Forsberg, which hasn't
threatened
us?
We know these arguments. We've made them.
But,
we've worked them over plenty right here, and
we
yet
have,
they didn't carry
the
day.
They didn't come through on the media is what I'm saying. What came through from the protests that got into the media was there are a lot of people that think it's about oil and that we shouldn't do it. What didn't come through was the more detailed arguments where the president got the kind of attention one needs for those detailed arguments when he spoke or when Powell spoke.
Without
the people on the other side didn't get through.
David Korn, you've been watching this as well. You've been paying a lot of attention to it. There has been a lot of activity. Many individuals here and abroad have committed weekends and evenings and church basement meetings and you name it to the peace protest. What's your assessment of its impact? Does war mean that it's failed? And what else should we be reading between the lines here?
Well, let's start with some fundamental principles. To begin with, the peace movement couldn't succeed. By that, I mean that the administration was hell-bent on this type of war and was not really persuadable, I think, for better or worse.
No matter what the poll numbers might have said?
I think there came a point in time when Bush committed himself to this endeavor that the poll numbers really didn't matter. And the poll numbers are very confused. If you ask the public, will you support sending in U.S. troops to topple Saddam Hussein, a majority say yes. If you ask the public, do you support giving the U.N. and inspections more time, a majority says yes.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, they take the French position if you put it to them without using the F word.
Mm.
So there's a lot of conflicting emotion in the public, which is understandable. Most people do not think about these affairs in the linear terms that those of us who are paid to look at them each day do.
But in fairness, even if this had been a different administration, well, it's too huge a hypothetical, but was this really a peace protest of such a volume that it would have stopped any administration headed toward war?
theoretically, if you had 20 million people in the streets, it might have had some impact.
But we didn't.
But you didn't. And that was bound not to happen. And the other thing that's, you know, the other structural impediment, I mean, I think the peace movement has, you know, didn't, you know, get off the mark quickly, and there were some problems with it. But I think the other structural impediment it faced is that the political system, as constituted, really decided this wasn't an issue of debate. They, you know, had one debate in October and giving Bush the power to launch war whenever he felt like it, mm-hmm. on his own. And the Democrats, the party of opposition, mm-hmm. are split on the war issue. And so, and the National Democrats, the, i.e. those running for president, most of them, at least the ones who command a lot of attention, seem to be in favor of war, at least not willing to speak out fully against it. Maybe they're in favor of going to the UN, but they're not against the war in and of itself.
So you're saying the one material lever was given away by Congress early on. The
piece... Well, I mean, if you're going to try to create political pressure, it's easier to do it if the system is actually dealing with the question at the time, mm-hmm. and it wasn't. It was all locked up. The political game was rigged. So it would take a tremendous effort on the part of any mm-hmm. social movement to bring any pressure to bear. I mean, having said that, I think there were some problems. I mean, it's wonderful that groups got involved and protested before an actual war. That is somewhat historic, and the numbers that Randy Forsberg gave out, you know, are indeed historic. They raised the bar here. But at the same time, you know, some of the mainline, more established peace and justice groups in the country were slower off the mark to develop an on-the-ground presence, and at the earliest stage of the peace movement, some of the rallies were organized by what I would tend to call political cultists, far-left socialist revolutionaries who attached a lot of the messages to the anti-war movement. Now, I think most of the people who came to those rallies, you know, didn't know the difference. They just knew mm-hmm. it was an anti-war rally, and they wanted to go somewhere to show that they were opposed to this. But I think, you know, we see a lot of, you know, in the last 2-3 months, a lot of mainline church groups, the National Council on Churches, you see some of the environmental groups like Sierra Club getting much more involved. And again, I don't think any peace movement could have stopped this, any realistic peace movement could have stopped this war. But had these groups got involved a little bit earlier, we might have seen a little bit more activity, larger numbers, more ferment out there that might have eventually forced the media to look at this a little bit earlier than it ended up doing. It was very easy for the media to go to these early demonstrations, and to them, a lot of people in the media, you know, a movement is only, you know, these big rallies that I held. It's not the little stuff that goes on across the country. It's what goes on in New York.
It's just
and
how big a number.
Excuse me?
It's just how big a number.
You know, how big a number, what goes on in New York or Washington. Mm-hmm. I hate to tell our Bostonian listeners that. And if some of these early rallies are being mounted by people who are going on about smashing Zionism and freeing Mumia al-Jamar and smashing capitalism, it was easy to them to say, listen, this is just sort of fringe stuff going on. And so,
this, you know, is the sort of workers' world party behind some of the early
Monday morning quarterbacking, for sure. But it would have been wonderful if some of these more established peace groups had sort of gotten into a more obvious, visible position earlier on.
Randall Forsberg, let me put it to you.
Yeah.
Did the United States, for one, come anywhere near the critical mass that would have been required to stop this war? Was there a critical mass that might have stopped this war? Or do you agree with David that it was never going to be stopped?
No, I do. I agree with David. I think that the administration decided, I mean, we now know there's evidence that before 9/11, there were people in the administration talking about having a war with Iraq and getting rid of Saddam Hussein, and that this is
way
a long-term
before.
Plan. So I think it's hell-bent on having this war is correct. I would just add, in late January, Senators Kennedy and Byrd introduced a resolution to try to get the president to come back to the Senate. Both of them have given fabulous speeches against the war.
Mm.
I think the role of the Democratic Party in not opposing the war, the Senate and, you know, the little support in the Senate and puny support in the House compared with what it might have been, was a big factor. I think another factor that many people haven't thought about is foundation funding for the mainline peace groups has been cut by a factor of two or three.
Funding for the peace groups, hold the thought, Randall Forsberg. Yeah. We're talking tonight, we're asking tonight, I guess, does war in Iraq mean the peace movement was a failure? What do you think? Do bombs over Baghdad mean the movement was a bust? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We are asking tonight, does war in Iraq mean the peace movement was a failure? Did the peace movement make a difference? In peace movements, is fighting the good fight enough? And did you believe that the peace movement might actually stop the war? Or did it make war more likely? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined in the studio tonight by Randall Forsberg, Executive Director of the Institute for Defense and Disarmament Studies in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and a big figure in peace movements for a long time. From Tacoma Park, Maryland tonight, by Washington editor of The Nation, David Korn. And right now, and very happy to be so, from London by Mary Calder. She's professor of global governance and director of the Center for the Study of Global Governance at the London School of Economics, a leader in the anti-nuclear movement in the 1980s and the anti-Iraq war movement. Right now, Mary Calder, good evening. Very
good
late
evening
there, and thanks for joining us.
I'm very happy to be joining you.
Mary Calder, you've got a unique perspective looking from London. You saw enormous turnouts, historic turnouts in London for anti-war rallies. You had a front row seat there on everything going on in Europe. You've also been in the U.S. during the period where there were peace marches, rallies, speeches, all the rest right here. What's your, I guess, the bald question to you first, does the fact that the war is going ahead mean that all this peace movement activity failed?
Well, I think in one sense, of course, it did. We failed to stop the war. But I think we did have some real achievements. I think that it's very unlikely that Bush and Blair will want to repeat this. And one of my great fears about this war was that it was the beginning of a long-term strategy of preemption. I think it'll be very, very difficult for them ever to try this again. Certainly, Blair, I think, will never unconditionally give Bush the same sort of support. He has only just this evening scraped through the parliamentary vote.
Yes, well, maybe so for Blair, but I have to just note there that I wonder about Bush. You know, we talk with his crew all the time, and I'm not sure they're dissuaded from further preemptive war. But point taken, there's a kind of bar laid down.
Things. I mean, I yes. think the fact that when they came back from the Azores, they had to announce the roadmap for Israel and Palestine. The fact that they now say the UN will be responsible for reconstruction. The fact that many, many people feel that the fact that the UN did not simply endorse this war, actually far from sidelining the UN, has in some senses strengthened it, and that we may in fact end up with greater multilateralism, not less. So I think there are some, and finally the fact that I think those troops going into Iraq are going to be much more conscious of the need to protect civilian lives than they might have been otherwise.
Fair points. Mary Calder, you've been so close to this, these movements for such a long time. Beyond this bald question of, you know, it obviously didn't stop the war, but take us past that. What's your sense of the changing character? Is there a changing character to the quality of peace activism that you saw this time out of the peace movement? Randall Forsberg and David Korn noting here that it is perhaps historic in the strength to which it emerged before the war even began, but is there more in the texture of it itself that we should be paying attention to?
Well, I think what's new is the fact that it was, as Randy said, truly global. That was extraordinary. Certainly what was new, I was on the march on February the 15th, and what was new was that there were literally thousands, hundreds and thousands of people who had never been on demonstrations before.
And this is the demo, we were told, maybe 2 million in London, perhaps the largest
absolutely.
Demo ever in history.
I mean, it was the most extraordinary demonstration I've ever seen. And also the fact that completely new groups are coming together. I mean, on the one hand, you have the people who've been campaigning about globalization from Porto Alegre and all the rest. But then you have the traditional anti-war peace movement. And then you have the Muslim community. And it wasn't just the Muslim community in London. It was really basically the entire Asian community. There were many Hindus as well as Muslims on the march, and that was something new. It was the first time they'd been engaged in politics. So I think this was all new. One of my concerns is actually that, in a sense, I felt that the feeling of the people on the march was not reflected by the speeches and by the leadership.
And what do you mean in particular there, Mary Calder?
Well, one of my worries was that I think one of the lessons we learned in the European peace movement in the 80s was that we took a very strong position both against nuclear weapons and against communism. And we felt it was very important to unite the opposition in Eastern Europe with the anti-war movement. Now, everybody on that anti-war march was opposed to Saddam Hussein very strongly, but we didn't have enough banners saying no to Saddam Hussein and no to war. And the result was that Baghdad Television was able to show our march solidly for 2 days. And if we'd flooded the demonstration with no to Saddam as well as no to war, he couldn't have done that.
Why wasn't that there? Was anti-Americanism coming in here so strong, the resentment towards President Bush, that it made people blind to the Saddam issue, or just made it a second-tier issue?
I think it made it a second-tier issue, which in a sense it was. I think, you know, a lot of people in Britain supported the war in Kosovo, for example. They are concerned about human rights. There is a very large Iraqi community living in London and a very large Kurdish community, and they do care about what happens in Iraq. And the reason they're opposed to the war is not because they like Saddam Hussein, but because they are very deeply concerned about the strategy of the Bush administration and very deeply concerned about war in general. I think there is a sense in Europe, particularly in France and Germany, but also even in Britain, that war is no longer a legitimate way to settle disputes.
I guess let me ask off that.
Multilateral legal route.
Let me ask off that point, Mary Calder. You saw protests in the UK, in Europe, and in the US. Did you see a different tenor on this side of the Atlantic from yours?
Well, I didn't actually see the demonstrations, but I met lots of the anti-war groups in the US, and as a matter of fact, I thought that there were a lot more sophisticated strategy discussions going on among the groups that I met in the US than I actually experienced among the groups in Britain. In a way, what my feeling about the huge demonstration we had was that it was many, many individuals. I mean, it was coordinated, yes, but the kind of debate that I experienced when I was in the United States, I don't think were going on to the same degree in Britain, at least not within the framework of the anti-war movement.
Let me put that to Randall Forsberg, if I may. Randall Forsberg, what about your assessment of the animating ideas of this peace movement at its core? I guess at its core and then in mass, were they the same? What are the big ideas or small ones behind what was going on here?
Well,
I should ask as well.
I think probably maybe there was just more articulated discussion. I'm not sure. There certainly is a division within the protest movement between people who are pacifists on the one hand and don't want to see any war, and people who are not pacifists but who would still agree with Mary Calder's comment that, you know, war, it just isn't the way we do things anymore, and you have to find better ways. You have to find things that are more narrowly focused on problems and on addressing and dealing with problems and not just sort of go around bashing people. So I think that the idea that was on the other side of the pacifist community was the idea that if you continued the inspections and then maybe you followed that up with kind of pushing on specific points, that ultimately you would be able to disarm Saddam Hussein and maybe, you know, continue to foment change from within. And support for change from within.
From within Iraq.
So, yes, and I think that that's one of the reasons you didn't see more signs against Saddam Hussein here either, that people didn't want to appear to be supporting war because they were opposing his, you know, sort of gruesome genocide and violations of human rights.
David Korn, what's your sense of the kind of animating ideas at the heart of this peace movement this time?
Well, I think there's a lot of, as Randy said, just a lot of competing thrusts. People are brought to this for different reasons. The rallies and events I've seen, you have traditional, you know, peacenik types, and then you have folks who are concerned that America should not become an occupying force, that it's not in our national security interest. You have people like Wesley Clark, you know, who's not at the demonstrations, but who say that this is not good for the war on terrorism. He's a former NATO commander who thinks this war is not a good idea. And so you have a lot of, you know, different motivations bringing people together, which makes it harder for the movement to have a general strategic plan or even, you know, an alternative. One problem I mentioned earlier was that at the beginning, some of these rallies were sponsored by some far left groups that basically don't believe in putting pressure on Saddam Hussein. While most,
some even support him, as you've written.
What?
Some even support him rhetorically, as you've written.
Perhaps, but at least 90%, if not more so, the people attending the rallies disagreed with that. But yet you didn't have, you know, as many speakers from the stage presenting a strategic alternative to war, whether it be, you know, more inspections or even coercive inspections. I mean, one frustration and I think the overall debate, not just for the peace movement, but for anybody who wants to have a vibrant democracy, is that, you know, Bush, with his gigantic megaphone and large, oversized bully pulpit, gets up there day after day and says, well, the option, you know, I don't believe inaction is an option. The only option is my option, which is war. And he dismisses the idea that there are other alternatives that have been out there, either proposed by other nations or proposed by other people here in America, other political figures and such. And it could be that those are not good options. It could be that those options, you know, won't succeed. But it's harder for the media to explore them. I think when Bush is out there saying it's this or nothing.
When he's got the big, big bullhorn. Mary Keller, it's very late there in London, and I don't want to keep you up too much longer. You've been great joining us. But your final thoughts on lessons taken away from the peace movement this time. What have you learned?
Well, I think I've learned how important global links are. I think, you know, I think it's going to be, I really do think that it's much, much more difficult, going to be much more difficult to fight this war, knowing that the United States and Britain are very isolated in terms of global opinion.
I think
there is a new sense in the rest of the world that we don't always have to do what the United States says. And I think that's going to be an enormous change in the future in how world affairs are followed. So I think, you know, that's very much on the plus side. On the negative side, what I would like to see is much more emphasis, not simply on stopping our governments, but also on how we deal with this difficult problem of horrible dictators in various parts of the world in a globalized era.
Mary Caldor, it's late. You've been great to join us, and I thank you very much for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
Mary Caldor is director of the Center for the Study of Global Governance at the London School of Economics. She joined us from London. You can join the conversation as well at 1-800-423-8255. I want to welcome into our conversation now from Berkeley, California, Michael Lerner. He's editor of Tycoon Magazine, and we're delighted to have him on tonight. Good evening and welcome, Michael Lerner.
Hi.
Thanks for joining us tonight. Michael Lerner, you had an interesting experience in the peace movement this time. You wrote some about it in the Wall Street Journal, and many people have talked about it. Can you describe to us your experience of the peace movement pre-war in Iraq?
Mm-hmm. Well, yes. One dimension of that experience that I wrote about in the Wall Street Journal was the fact that one of the main organizing groups of the anti-war movement was a group called International Answer. And Answer had structured the rallies in such a way in the United States in which many, many speakers spoke not primarily about Iraq or only but with a special focus on attacking Israel and singling out Israel's human rights abuses. Now, I'm the editor of Tikkun magazine, T-I-K-K-U-N, and Tikkun is the world's largest Jewish magazine that's critical of Israeli policy. We think that Israel has to get out of the West Bank and create a Palestinian state and provide reparations for the Palestinian people. We're very critical of Israeli policy. Mm-hmm. But many of the Tikkun people who share those criticisms went to these rallies and came back feeling that they were in an anti-Semitic context because the only criticisms of any country that were being articulated apart from the United States were being directed at Israel. Meanwhile, there was no criticism of the far worse human rights abuses going on in Iraq by Saddam Hussein, much less any of the other horrible human rights violations going on in any other place in the world.
So, Michael Lerner, what do you take away from that? Was this vein of anti-Semitism, as people describe it, perceived it, key? Was it a real problem? Was this a sideshow in the peace mood, or was it a real problem?
It was a real problem because it pushed away many liberal and progressive Jews who might otherwise have played an important role. You know, in every other progressive movement up till this point, Jews have played a vastly disproportionate role in, and the Jewish community in the United States, although moving in a more conservative direction, still is more against this war than any other non-African-American community. In other words, the Jews in the United States have the highest percentage of opposition to this war of any other ethnic group in the United States except for African-Americans. Mm. So the Jews who could have played an important role were pushed away. And personally, was that having criticism of this in the public sphere, I was then told, people who suggested that I speak were told to speak in, I could not give a speech at the anti-war rally because I had raised criticisms of ANSWER in public. Well, that's only one dimension of the problems of the anti-war movement, but it was a significant problem.
Michael Lerner, we want to talk more with you about your experience there. But David Korn, let me get your observations first on Michael Lerner's experience. How strong was this the push against Zionism in the peace movement at its core, at its periphery, and how significant has that been in the outcome here?
Well, it goes back to the point I was making earlier, that at the start of, you know, this peace movement, that often the demonstrations were being organized by a group called ANSWER, which is dominated by revolutionary socialists who consider themselves anti-Zionist, and they have a lot of other matters on their agenda, and they would load up the speaker's platform with stuff that was indeed peripheral to a strong anti-war message. And, you know, to what degree this kept people away, I can't say. It certainly didn't help. It certainly didn't bring more people in, and to the degree to which you make anybody uncomfortable who wants to join an anti-war protest, it's not a good thing. Now, I think fortunately, these folks have been supplanted by more mainstream peace groups getting involved in organizing, and on the weekend that Michael Lerner is talking about, the rally that was held in San Francisco had this group ANSWER participating in its organization. The outfits that were putting on the big rally in New York did not. Mm-hmm. They did not have the problem that Michael ran into there. So I think, you know, Michael's episode forced the issue further, and I think further marginalized this small band of people who are not reflective or representative, I think, of the people coming to these rallies, and are more an organizational obstacle who I think have more or less been overcome.
So it wasn't wall-to-wall, but it was a factor. David Korn, I know we have to let you go, and I want to thank you so much for joining us tonight.
My pleasure.
David Korn is Washington editor of The Nation. His most recent book is Deep Background. We are asking tonight, does war in Iraq mean the peace movement was a failure? Did you believe that the peace movement might stop the war? Did it make war more likely? This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We are asking tonight, does war in Iraq mean the peace movement was a failure? I'm joined in the studio tonight by Randall Forsberg, director of UrgentCall.org, a national web-based coalition for education on arms control issues. And from Berkeley, California tonight by Rabbi Michael Lerner, editor of Tikkun magazine. You are welcome to join the conversation as well. Were you on the peace train? Are you still? And where's it going now? What arguments for peace spoke to you? What left you cold? And is it progress that peace protests came before the war? Did it matter? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Tom's calling from Boston. Hi, Tom. You're on the air. Hello, Tom. Are you there? Looks like we don't have Tom. Let's turn to Michael calling. Welcome, Michael. You're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call, Tom.
Sure, good to have you.
I think that the peace movement's assertion that the inspections were working was a joke, and that was their downfall. We didn't go into Iraq to find Al-Samud missiles. We went in there to disarm Saddam of his bio and nuclear and chemical weapons. Saddam didn't give up a drop. The only reason the inspectors were on the ground in the first place is the 200,000-plus U.S. troops massed at his border. Saddam only understands one thing and one thing only, and that's force.
And the peace movement, you say, just didn't get that. Michael Lerner, let me put that to you. Who's being realistic and unrealistic here? Was it realistic to think the inspections could ultimately solve this problem? Our caller says, Michael says no.
Well, you see, the way of defining the problem, I think, is very, very relevant here. And if you define the problem as disarming another country, yes, you're not going to get that fully achieved by inspections. There needed to be a great deal of pressure put on Saddam Hussein. However, the idea that that could be achieved simply by the United States going in there and making a war is also an unacceptable alternative. And I think that the fundamental issue that the peace movement missed, and I think this caller is right to say, hey, they were saying the inspections are working when they weren't really working, but the question is whether that whole strategy of disarming Saddam Hussein was the appropriate way to go at this historical moment. And I believe that what the anti-war movement failed to do was to raise the question fundamentally of what security is about and how do you achieve security in the world. Do you achieve security through domination and control over others, or do you achieve security through cooperation with others? Now, if you starve the population of Iraq for 10 years, yes, you can create enough resistance there so that people are even willing to support their own a horrible dictator and willing to go along with him and willing to follow orders from him, that, in fact, there are other ways to overthrow such a regime, but you have to do it in a way that doesn't involve the notion of invasion, power over, domination, control over. So, for example, we have the alternative vision of how you deal with a far worse dictatorship, far more horrendous to its own people, namely the Soviet Union. And there, we contained them at the borders, but we also didn't try to starve the people. We didn't contribute to their misery in their own country. Instead, we contained them militarily and then allowed the dynamics of that country to work its way out. And in fact, in a peaceful way, the Soviet Union, far worse of a society than Iraq, far more repressive than Iraq, managed to dissolve internally from the contradictions of living in a totalitarian society. So you have two different images of how to destroy totalitarianism. One is go out and nuke them or bomb them until they die, or the other one is contain them and then work allow the human processes to undermine a totalitarian regime.
And yet, of course, we know that the White House has made the argument, and we've had it made on this show many times, that that simply wouldn't work this time, that there's too much leakage here, that things, that bad stuff can end up in Manhattan, and we've seen that's the case. And
well, they could have made that argument in 1963 when nuclear weapons were potentially being delivered to Cuba.
Well, they might have, and of course there was action taking when nuclear weapons were taken to Cuba. But I want to go, Randall Forsberg, if I may, to kind of the heart of something that Michael Lerner said here, there were other ways, and they should have been pursued. But
articulated by the anti-war movement.
The anti-war movement
did not do a good job of presenting an alternative vision.
But I want to ask something more material here, and I'll put it to Randall first, if I may. Does it go to the credibility, does it detract from the credibility of the peace movement that during all those years of the 90s, when everything else was going on and Saddam was doing whatever he was doing and evading and kicking out inspectors, that we didn't hear a great hue and cry from an alternate movement then to organize Iraqi society to push this man out, that it left it to George Bush to take the bit in the teeth, maybe not in the way the peace movement liked, but to step up and say, we're going to do something here. It wasn't until then that we saw people in the streets.
Well, you know, what about Burma? What about Rwanda? I do not think it's our responsibility or that it's appropriate to deal with gross abuses of human rights by, you know, selectively picking a country which happens to be the world's second largest oil producer and saying, well, in this case, we need to use military force to overthrow the dictator. But in these other cases that have been going on, those aren't our business. We don't need to go in there. So I do think that it's important for the international community to support human rights. But the way you do that is not by being selective. It's by having a body of international law which outlines things that are abuses and kinds of responses to them, where you bring people, where you establish the guidelines ahead of time, and you bring people along in the international community if you're going to get involved in trying to look at changing things within countries, which is entirely new after the end of the Cold War. Before the end of the Cold War, this wasn't even an issue.
But still, what were the millions out on the streets, kind of no-show people in the 90s when Iraq was suffering, when Saddam Hussein was still a tyrant? You see what I mean? Michael Lerner says there's got to be a different way, a way that's not about force. But doesn't that then depend on people, not necessarily governments in every case? Mm-hmm. Michael Lerner, I'll put it to you. Is there an element of responsibility for a decade of kind of, you know, happy, cheap oil and, oh, okay, it's not good what's going on in Iraq, but we're not out in the streets about it?
Yes, definitely irresponsibility. But you see, the way to provide security, we have to look at the big picture. And if you want, and the alternative was not being provided by the Democrats, by the liberals, by any of the people who had power in the 1990s. That alternative, in my view, is if you want security for the United States, there are three things that can be done very quickly and decisively. If the United States is and is perceived to be the world's leading force for eliminating poverty, hunger, homelessness, lack of education, and lack of health care all around the world, if the United States, number two, is perceived and is perceived to be and is, in fact, the leading force in the world for ecological sanity and for repairing the destruction of the environment that has happened over in the advanced industrial societies over the course of the past 150 years. And number three, if the United States is and is perceived to be a society that embodies a new ethos of generosity and kindness, which is reflected in all of our institutions internally and in our foreign policy, those three things together would provide far more security than all of the wars that George Bush has planned for the United States in the course of the next several years.
Michael Lernergott, I want to get one more call in here. Scott's calling from Erie, Pennsylvania. Hi, Scott. You're on the air.
Thanks a lot, Tom.
Sure.
Let me tell you, this topic on this program is long, long overdue. A couple of points really quickly. First off, I don't understand why we're talking about the current anti-war movement in the past tense.
Right.
I mean, that's astounds me.
Well, it's just the pre-war phase we're looking at, but point taken.
You know, we were talking about how the media has presented this current anti-war movement. That's right there as a prime example. I mean, we're constantly compared to the generation of the past. We're also told that our movement is being led by what's left of the old left from the 1960s and such like that. I mean, that's the kind of perceptions we're dealing with at all times.
So, Scott, you're saying that this peace movement's future is still ahead of it.
I do believe there's a lot of future ahead of it, especially because of the policies of this current administration, the policy of a preemptive action, for crying out loud. Secondly, I would want to say that if you remember correctly, in the 1960s, it took a long, long time for the peace movement to be taken seriously or even be listened to by the administration. I was a part of the rally this past Saturday in Washington, D.C., where about 100,000 people showed up for this. And let me tell you something. It started to feel a lot like Richard Nixon sitting in the White House with his back turned to the window and watching a football game. President Bush was in Camp David at the time, couldn't be so bothered.
Scott, we've got it. Our time is growing short. I want to thank you for your call from Erie, Randall Forsberg.
Yeah.
How about it? Is this just the beginning? Is this movement going to go on? Do you think it can sustain during and beyond this war? If the war is only 2 months, who knows?
Right.
But is it too late?
Well, that was, in fact, a point I had noted down. I was going to try to squeeze in that you should stop talking about it in the past tense, especially since we know that on the day the war starts, there are going to be huge demonstrations all over the country at 5 o'clock by the city hall in towns all over the country. That's already been planned. Mm. In Boston on Wednesday, there's going to be a day of mourning. Because of the war. So obviously, if it's a very short war, if it's a month, then the peace movement isn't going to go on for years. But I think that you're going to see a bigger peace movement in the next month than you've seen in the last two.
And with that, unfortunately, we are out of time. It's been great having you all. Randall Forsberg, director of UrgentCall.org, a national web-based coalition for education on arms control issues. Thank you for joining us tonight.
My pleasure.
And Michael Lerner in Berkeley, editor of Tikkun Magazine. Thank you very much for coming on Point.
Absolutely. Thanks.
It's been great having you. Listeners, you can continue this conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. In a moment, reflections from a reluctant peace protester. This is On Point. Patty Perrin had never considered herself a peace activist. In fact, it took some arm-twisting to get the Ashland, Oregon resident to take part in a recent last-ditch anti-war rally in her small town. But as she stood alongside 200 fellow women protesters, Patty began to realize something. She realized she was giving voice to a group that has been nearly silent in the raging debate over Iraq. In this radio diary, Patty Perrin reflects on her stint as an anti-war activist.
I am a woman in black. For half an hour last week, I stood dressed all in black beside the main street of my town, staring silently ahead. When I began my vigil, I was uncertain why I was there and probably would not have gone except that an activist friend made me feel guilty. "They need more white hair," she explained. "If we don't show up, who will?" I didn't want to go, but I also knew I felt terribly frustrated and unlistened to. Maybe this would help. I know war. I lost all my teen years to war. I lost my son's youth to war. And if standing there I could make a difference, I had to try. It was a very cold day, so I put on layer after layer of clothing, knowing the standing would intensify the cold. Ashland is a small town, yet 180 women, all ages, gathered and stood shoulder to shoulder along our main street. On one side of me was my old friend, on the other a much younger woman who wore sunglasses on a cloudy day. One woman had brought a child, a little girl about 4, dressed all in black, a somber, quiet child. Our vigil was only a half hour, but standing still in the cold for half an hour is difficult. But I soon got my body adjusted. I watched the cars going by. Some of the people in the cars honked, and others were careful not to look at us. Physically, I began to quiet down, but not my mind. It flitted. The question kept coming up, why was I here? I watched the trees across the street and noted they were starting to bud. Yes, there will be a spring, I said to myself. I wanted to focus on anything except what I was doing. Someone, as we were gathering, had suggested that we pray, so I began. I find myself reverting to the prayers of my childhood, the rosary. Hail Mary, full of grace. The rhythm of the prayer quieted me, and it seemed apt that I be addressing another mother. My mind began to focus on my task, and I realized I was there because women the world over are not being heard. I was standing there for all women, and especially the women of Iraq. I found myself imagining some Iraqi woman standing beside me. Maybe the lady in the sunglasses. She would be some mother who also loves her country, her home, and her family. A woman who does not want to be bombed. An Islamic mother. Holy Mary, Mother of God, pray for us sinners now and at the hour of our death.
Patty Perrin is a freelance writer and writing teacher. She lives in Ashland, Oregon. Listeners, as conflict with Iraq approaches, we want to hear your story. How is the looming war affecting your life? What are you hearing from family or friends at home or overseas? How are you struggling to understand this war and this world? What are you writing in your journal? What are you telling your kids? If you have a story that would make a good radio diary, email us. The address is onpoint@wbur.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBUR.